It's my great pleasure to introduce our guest speaker this morning. Dr. Craig Nelson is currently the Medical Bioethics Director at Kaiser Permanente Medical Center in South Bay. He has been a clinical laboratory scientist for 38 years. He's worked in bioethics since 1988 and has formerly lectured at Cal State University Fullerton in both liberal studies and comparative religion. He's completed programs in both science and religion from Cal Poly University, Pomona, USC-LSC School of Medical Technology, Loyola Marymount University, and Claremont Graduate University.
Good morning. I must say your congregation is very winsome. I feel very welcomed. I even realized that I sat in the right part of this church because with him, 1009, I did have an easy part with the help of Alice Dyer. Thank you. But I do want to mention that I feel a strong kinship with Joseph Priestley because both he and I have a yearning and an eagerness to dwell and work in religion and science. In fact, I have an elderly aunt who's in her 90s who often will say, "How long have you been working for Kaiser now?" And I'll say, "Well, it's been a long time. It's been over 30 years. And she'll say, "Well, when are you going to become a doctor?" And I said, "Well," I always say, "Well, Auntie, I already am a doctor." And she says, "No, no, no. I mean a real doctor. You know, the kind that helps people." So hopefully in some of my work I feel I do help people, but I understand that my parents really wanted me to be either a Catholic priest or a physician, and in those days those were the high marks. Well, I did make either one, but I did dwell in religion and science, which I love very much. And so today I'm going to be talking a little bit about what I do in bioethics. Bioethics really talks about those controversial issues, these issues that come from the boundaries of life to the allocation of scarce resources. That's the larger umbrella, but I focus on medical ethics. And what I do in the practice of medicine as a medical ethicist is help people be an instrument of staying in touch with human dignity and all of its demands. So, of course, there's a lot of philosophy involved. There's my background as a clinical scientist involved because I'm able to understand what doctors are saying, understand how patients need to be addressed, and perhaps even understand how patients need to ask questions. But I'm reminded by one of my great heroes, Dr. Edmund Pellegrino, who is in his 90s, still working in medical ethics. He says, "Medicine is the most humane of the sciences, the most empiric of the arts, and the most scientific of the humanities." And so when I think about what I do day in and day out, it's not just maxims, principles, philosophy, theories. It's actually jumping in and delving into the humanities in a way that helps others, because the humanities really need to be lived. They need to be lived in our lives. And so the humanities help us deal with what it means to be human. They help us by putting us in touch with the dramatic, the artistic, the meaning of language, symbol, myth, mythos, freeing our minds. I mean, this doesn't sound like it might be something that you'd find in a medical center, but this is one of the tools of ethics that I bring to the fore. I am not the font of wisdom. When I'm called on by my physician colleagues, I do not bring the wisdom answer. I gather the appropriate community of concern to talk in terms about what should be best done for this context. And the humanities are often one of my tools. So the humanities also tell us something about virtue. And I'm reminded of Robert Coles, who writes so well about this. He uses story, a classical story, a story of persons that he's met to teach ethics, to understand the real-time ethics at work in life. And so when we look at the humanities, we also understand that they support medicine's virtuous response to actual patients. When we engage the humanities, we somehow put into clinical context the kind of education we need to teach our physicians. And so that's part of what I do. I actually work with physicians to help them speak better, to help them understand better, to help them communicate better, to help them mediate. And so In doing so, the community that I work with, the other ethicists, there are now 8 of us in Kaiser Permanente. They're planning to put 1 in each medical center. We try to look at, together collectively, and reflect upon what are the virtues of a good physician. How many of you have ever gone to a physician? We all have, right? I mean, and as we turn more white, we go more. And so certainly what we want to look at is how we can help our physicians and the medical staff that works with them have more fidelity to trust and promise. These are things that are so important in your relationship to a physician, to a healthcare provider. To understand that physicians need to be able to embrace benevolence. You know, that kindness that we would want to have, that kindness of touch, not the abruptness and rushness. Sometimes that medicine often puts physicians in as their context, say in an emergency setting. We want to walk into a place where the doctors, the physicians, have somehow effaced their self-interest. We don't want somebody that's got their own agenda. I mean, certain times when I meet with families, my social worker colleague will say, "We don't have any agenda." But I always do say, I do have an agenda. I want to help honor your human dignity. I want to be a conduit of how that can happen better. So, you know, we want to make sure that our self-interest isn't put in the front of what we do with our patients. So we also look at the other kinds of marks that we would want to see in a physician as we would visit one. Prudence, compassion, understanding of what justice is, and intellectual honesty. And so often when I work with families and with patients, I relate stories. I'm a storyteller. I love to tell stories. My kids have gone now from the age of thinking my stories are boring to thinking that they might have something okay to say because they're in their 30s, so you know they have grown up a little. But it's often been said that the straightest line between the human person and the truth often runs through a story. And so here's a story. There was a young man who was traveling through this vast desert. And as he was traveling through this desert, he happened upon this pond, this oasis, this water that just was crystalline and cool and delicious and amazing. How many of you ever hiked in the mountains and had some just great mountain water? I mean, there's almost nothing like it. But this was in a desert. And so this young person said, "Oh, this water is amazing. It's wonderful. I need to take this back to my teacher." And so he puts it in his skins. Wineskin and says, "Oh, my teacher will love this." And so he sojourns about 4 days through the desert and comes to his village. And he comes upon his teacher with this great joy and says, "Teacher, I have come across this great water. It's amazing. This water is just, it's almost exciting to drink it. It's just so delicious. And I brought it for you." And the teacher, very wise, said, "Well, thank you." And took the water and tasted it. And looks at him and says, "This water is the most amazing water I've ever had in my life. I've never had anything like it. Thank you." And of course, off to the side, there was a younger student watching all this. And so he goes up to the master and says, the master teacher, and says, "Can I taste this water?" And so he gives him a taste. And the young person tastes it and goes, he says, "This water is the worst I've ever tasted. It's horrible. It's bitter. It tastes like skin. It's yucky." He said, "How come you told him that this water was so amazing?" And the wise teacher says, "Ah, you tasted the water, but I tasted the gift." And I think that when I reflect on what happens in medical ethics is that what I bring is not just by myself, but I bring the gift of moral space. That time in a patient's visit to a medical center where the professionals need to stand back, to take a look at what they're doing, to understand maybe more deeply how to value and serve the good of their patients, to honor values and obligations and not just rush through hearing what their medical ailments might be. And sometimes it even involves navigating through institutional challenges. We all have them wherever we work. Even a great place like Kaiser Permanente, it has plenty because it's human, it's made by humans. And so the gift of moral space is also something that nurtures the understanding that all the schooling that I went to, and my wife is a saint because I probably went to graduate school, you notice there were a few schools I went to for maybe 14 years and it was over a long period of time. And so yes, there are some things I bring from that education, but I bring my person. It's my total person that I bring when I serve patients. It's not just that. So it's using these principles to serve people, not just to sound smart. So in essence, what I do is I help the collective community work together to do the right thing. Now, what is the right thing? Well, the right thing can have many faces, can't it? And so the mission that we have as ethicists for Kaiser Permanente is that we try to look at and focus upon the moral good of the patient. And Dr. Ed Pellegrino, and I brought one of his books that, if you're interested in further reading, it's amazing. It's an anthology of all of his work over the last 40 years. It really is looking at the patient's biomedical good, which is what we go to a physician for, right? We want them to tell us what's wrong, how they can help fix us, how perhaps they can either cure us or heal us. Now, I say there's a difference between those two, because not everybody is cured, but everybody can be healed in a sense, because healing is really that existential coming in touch with that things are going to be okay no matter what. And we all sort of want that, don't we? I mean, when we go to the doctor, I've just recently said goodbye to my mother, my favorite mother-in-law, who had very bad kidney disease. And I think what gave her the most peace at the end of her life wasn't the fact that she was going to be cured, but the fact that she came to grips with her lot. That she knew that she was surrounded by a loving family that was going to help her, helped her journey come to where it was going to end. And she was at peace. And she did experience some healing. And I felt that as a family we did a good job. So that's the patient's biomedical good. Also, we want to make sure that we're focusing on the patient's good from their own conception. You know, everybody comes with a belief, a non-belief, a bias. Bias is not necessarily bad, it just needs to be named. I mean, I come to you today as a Roman Catholic, but we all come with something, and I think we need to respect whatever that something is. And I think that's one of the things your congregation does so well, is that you embrace the holistic understanding of how people are and who they are. And I think that's what we try to do with our patients. We try to do that the best that we can. We try to look at their good from the way they look at their good. We also want to make sure that we're covering the understanding that the patient's human good is what a reasonable person would understand that good to be. So it comes in varieties. The patient as a member of the human species is special, is precious. And lastly, one of the things that Dr. Pellegrino mentions in his work and extols us to do is that we need to look at the patient's spiritual good, whatever that might be. Now, some people, you know, that I talk with don't want to talk about spirituality at all. Some come from maybe a Taoist kind of background or a Buddhist background where filial piety is an important part of the way in which they voice their autonomy. These are all tools of understanding spirituality that can help a patient's journey. So then the strategy we have is that we look at the patient's good through actually being there with them. What I do as an ethicist isn't just give talks. I actually am at bedside. I go to rounds every day with the physicians. I either am at general hospital rounds where we cover maybe 100 to 140 cases a day, or I'm at ICU rounds where we cover a smaller group of patients but more intense. And so I'm at bedside. I also work at the MOBs, the medical office buildings off-site. I service the long-term care facilities, the skilled nursing facilities, and address actually helping to pull together this moral space across the continuum. That is basically my job. So I also draw in the bioethics committee, which every hospital has. And it works, interestingly enough, bioethics committees are very, very important, but there was a major study done a few years ago that showed that they probably do in a large hospital maybe 6 consultations a year. And that's great because those are some of the larger cases that come to them as problems. But last year alone, I did about 120 and probably reviewed about 10,000 cases. So there's a difference between having a proactive way of doing ethics and just sort of waiting for some of the problems to come. And so I really am thankful that I have that part of ethics consultation at bedside as part of my job. I also work in preventive measures with ethics, preventive ethics, which it would be the kind of things you would expect: writing policy, having conversations early with families, doing collaborative events with different other organizations, other committees in the hospital community. I serve on the Physician Education Committee. I don't need to make a list. It's probably way too long, and I even sometimes bore my wife, and she's so kind to listen, but I don't think that it's really something that would be a surprise to anybody that somebody that works in ethics would want to pull together the collaborative ways in which the hospital community can communicate better. And then I also work in the region with other ethicists, doing public speaking, working on symposia, research, publishing several papers this year, doing research with how ethics consultation really helps people, if it does at all. Is there some kind of qualitative metric we can measure? And on and on. So, but what's interesting to note is that it isn't just me, it's the ethics committee. It's all the people involved in the healthcare endeavor at Kaiser that works in ethics. And we all work together at trying to bring a sense of deeper human dignity. We try to bring together the multiple silo effect, they call it, where we bring together different components of quality assurance, of risk management, of the physician medical leadership committees. And so work between them and among them to make the community of concern broader and more in-depth. So what is it that I do so much with a case? Well, there are some cases that are very interesting, and I think that, you know, you'll probably be asking me some questions after I'm finished, but there is one area that really is important. It's to have voice. Now, when we all go to the doctor, we want them to know what we think, don't we? We want them to hear our voice, to hear our heart, to understand how they can help us better. Well, there are some times when patients have no voice because they either have severe dementia, they've outlived all their family and friends, they come to the hospital, and who speaks for them? There needs to be some kind of process that helps them have human dignity. That's where I get involved. I try to pose an ethical question for the context, draw together the appropriate community to talk about it, and try to look at what should be done for this patient in their specific context that would honor their lived values as well as we could get to know them. And that's why story is so important, because I oftentimes tell families whose family member may never have talked to them about what they would like, the intensity of care that they would wish. And so I say, well, tell me about your loved one. Tell me their story. What did they do? How did they interact? What kinds of things did they enjoy? Because the stories always tell us something about the real person. And it's you know, when I review charts, it's kind of two-dimensional. It's a flat way of understanding somebody. I know how their biochemistry tests are. I understand what the physicians have done. But there's something about them that makes them specifically dear and human and wonderful that comes out in their story. Well, it's oftentimes, this is my goal, to understand a patient's story. Or to understand, perhaps, if they have filled out an advance directive. How many of you have heard of a healthcare directive? Oh, good, good. Usually I tell people when I'm speaking that anybody over 18 should fill one out, and I know that most of you probably aren't there yet, but, you know, it would be nice to still think about it, because you just never know. And it seems like the landmark cases in bioethics have always been young people. Young people who have either the need to be put on a respirator or to be tube fed, and they say, well, what would they have wanted for the long term? Would they have wanted this intensity? And of course, without having some kind of story or advanced directive, it's hard to know. So what I do is I look over the advanced directives, because a lot of times they're very specific, you know, take care of my cats, take care of my dogs, you know, and other times they're very vague, and they just say, I just don't want to have a lot of stuff happen to me that doesn't feel good or that's too burdensome. So what does that mean? We need to convene an ethics committee to really look at this more carefully. So we kind of navigate through the kinds of ways in which we can serve the greater good of the patients. So then all of us at Kaiser that I try to work with are trying to look at human dignity and all of its demands. And because it's so multifaceted, I can't, like I said earlier, have all the answers. I shouldn't have all the answers. Any ethicist that feels like they're the font of wisdom really must have some major problems, because human dignity is way too precious for any one person to feel like they have all of the answers and all of the insight. So how does bioethics help on a day-to-day basis for the staff, for example? Well, there are times where they may have moral uncertainty. They just don't know what the right thing is to do. They call me. We talk about it. Sometimes we meet as a group. There may be people who have are in the midst of a moral dilemma where nothing would be good. No answer would be good. Every choice is a bad choice. Which choice is less bad? You know, we need a conversation. We need to step back. We need to look at this more carefully. There may be those who would understand that they're having a moral problem. They just don't understand what might be legal or what might be even considered moral in a situation. And we have landmark cases. We have people like Dr. Pellegrino. We have people like Nancy Urban Walker. She's amazing. If you like feminist thinking, she's just amazing. She has written scores and scores of papers on moral space, has influenced my life greatly, and given me insight onto understanding how to muddle through some of these moral problems. And then, of course, people have moral distress almost every day in the hospital, in the medical center. And it's because Sometimes the institution, although it may be great, it may prevent them from doing the right thing because there's some obstacle that people hadn't noticed until today. What do we do? How do we maneuver through this? How do we make changes? How do we make it better? So I'm called upon for many different things, and yet I think what's dearest to my heart is that when I was, I must have been in my early 20s, I was a young scientist. I was first working at Kaiser, and I had been reading about the theories of bioethics. And I met a friend who was a castle builder that I didn't know yet, and he walked up to me and he says, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" And I said, "I want to be a bioethicist." He said, "What?" He said, "What's a bioethicist?" And I said, "Well, they don't have them yet, but they're going to someday. And I think they're going to have them in every hospital." Now, I wasn't really seeing into the future that well because I have a lot of ideas that have not come to pass. Ask my wife. But this one did. And, of course, my friend said, "I want to be a castle builder. I want to build a 12th century Norman castle." And so we became great friends, being a little, different. And I'm handy, so I helped him with his foundation and other things. And actually, it took him about the same length of time to build his castle as it did for me to become a bioethicist. So if you're ever in the Oak Glen area, in the Yucaipa area, you can visit George's castle. He'll give you the royal treatment if you mention my name. But in a sense, my castle has become my work. And that's why I go to work every day. It's become the thing that I wanted to be when I grow up. And I hope that all of you are blessed with that, no matter how young, no matter how mature you are, that you find that. Because I think that's what makes my work at Kaiser exciting. Because they wouldn't, don't quote me this, and I should probably turn the mic off, but they wouldn't have to pay me on some days because I think my job is so great. So thank you very much, and I will be around for questions later, and I hope that we can have some more conversation. Thank you.
We have a few minutes for questions or comments from the congregation.
It sounds like you derive much of your ethical, you ground your ethics in a sense of human dignity.
Yes.
Could you give an example, a recent example of a difficult moral choice that had to be made and how you were able to solve it from that point of view?
Thank you for that question. I really don't solve anything. I think I bring together the conversation where the wisdom comes from the group gathered. And what I try to do is I use my medical expertise as a clinical scientist and my theological training to try to bring together the right ways of honoring a person. So, for example, I can think of cases where specifically I've lobbied for more treatment, or specifically I've lobbied for perhaps a lesser aggressive type of treatment because what we were doing was not helping. So I had a patient recently that had MS that had filled out all of the advanced directives, did not want to be resuscitated, did not want to have a very much invasive treatment, but had very bad dentation. And so the physicians were sort of, trying to do everything they could to keep her comfortable in her context, the way in which she had decided to be treated. But they had overlooked the fact that her dentation was terrible and was causing her added pain. So it wasn't just my doing, but the doing of the ethics community that was gathered, that we were able to allow her to have somebody come into Kaiser, which Kaiser doesn't really have a dentistry program per se, but it does allow its employees, of course, to have coverage. So as a result of this need for her, now every Kaiser has a dentist that they have on site that can come and do this, can do dental work for patients who are in the intensive care. So this was a way in which her needs were met, and hopefully future patients would be too. And it seems like it may be a small thing, but it's such a subtle thing that sometimes it's overlooked by the treatment team, not because they don't want to do it, it's just that they don't always see all the facets that need to be done. There have been multiple cases where we would have people who have no one to speak for them. They're either homeless, indigent, or just elderly. And so we have a process of going through, what do we do when somebody doesn't have a surrogate? And it's gathering the community together, going through a process of understanding every rock that should be unturned for this patient's care, making sure once that is done, then we stop. You know, we don't try to flog people. We don't try to prolong their dying, in a sense. But then all of the things that I do are just recommended. Nothing that I do or say is necessarily followed. But most of the time, they follow my advice. And of course, everything I do is documented and charted. So it's, you know, I sort of have one step in this technical medical world and another one in this philosophy world, and try to take the phronesis, the phronetic understanding of wisdom, and infusing it more into the medical understanding of what should be done. So I don't know if that answers your question. Hundreds of cases I've been on, they're all different. Sometimes they're more involving intensive care, and sometimes they're just involving people who haven't had their questions answered well. And it's more of a type of mediation that needs to. Well, luckily, no. That's a very good question, and I'll tell you why. Because not that I'm extolling Kaiser, because there are other places that are equally as good. Cleveland Clinic, Mayo Clinic. We have no middle person. We don't have an insurance company. The doctors actually run the show. So when people come in, they don't have to call to say, can I do an MRI? They just order it. And we own all of our equipment, so it's something that we can cut costs with. So we really move away from that middle person. And I know that the new healthcare plan is trying to bring together a way of doing this better, perhaps. I'm not sure that we're going to be able to solve it in the short term. Hopefully in the long term we can. But I find that what happens more than not is that we're treating people who are homeless, who say medical center XYZ sends to Kaiser because they know we'll treat them. And they're more for a four-fee type of service. So we really don't run into that often. In fact, I think, you know, the last time I looked in our ICU, we had three people that were not members. So it's more of an issue of, I think, trying to find the appropriate way, the appropriate intensity to treat a patient when they come in. And that's my job. And so actually what I do is I my wife says, I can't believe people pay you for your advice. And I said, well, honey, you know, I'm really more like the court jester. You know, the court jester never got killed in the king's court. They just said, oh, that's just the court jester. So I really am free to say what I want, and they pay me to do that. And sometimes they like what I say, and sometimes they don't. But I really don't mind, because, like I said, this is my dream job, and I've worked for them long enough. So if they fire me tomorrow, well, who knows what I'll do. But I'd be certainly happy that I was able to at least do this job for a few years. I don't think they're going to fire me. Yeah, I think cost, that's a very good question. I think cost is always going to be a part of the conundrum, part of the discussion. But as an ethicist, what I feel is ultimately important would not be cost, but resources. You know, when you run out of Tamiflu, you're out. When you're out of AB positive blood, you don't have any. So I think it's more a matter of trying to use these resources well. Because you could be a wealthy, wealthy medical service, and if you run out of resources because you've squandered them on people who may never benefit from getting them in the first place, then you've really lost the preciousness of what you're trying to conserve. And it becomes a justice issue then, because you want to use what you have for those people that can benefit the most. And I'm not saying that you would make a triage list and say, oh, this person should get it and this person shouldn't, but so often we over-treat. We give people drugs, or we give them therapies that aren't helping them at all, and we never ask the question. So I think that's going to have to be done more and more. Patients are going to have to become more a part of the process. I know that I'm pushing for Kaiser to have patient advocacy panels where we have actually people from the community that help us make our medical decisions for the whole medical center. And that's probably going to be in the next decade that we're going to see that happening more, especially with we're going to get less money to do more things, and we're going to have to be wiser. What I try to do is I try to get under the story and try to find out a way to bring the people together, to make them collaborate, to find the common strands in what they're telling me about their loved one. Because what I try to emphasize to every family is it's not about you, 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 or you. It's about the person that's going through this part of their medical journey. And we want to serve their best interests, not yours. So it doesn't really matter if you're a pygmy or a Presbyterian. But you know, what we need to do is find out what their story tells us about what they would like, and try to honor that. And that's as far as I usually go with the discussion, because really, once a person has passed, you know, the family can just about do what they want. But I know that where I've been helpful, it's been where you have groups that don't understand each other, that aren't communicating well enough to come to some kind of conclusion, and I try to take a different
different scope or a different avenue, and I try to bring them together in a way that I have a case that where the family was very angry, and when they, I had no idea this was going to happen. When they called me in, they yelled at me for 45 minutes. And I finally realized what they were saying. So I got the doctor to come in and one of the administrators, and they didn't know what to say. But I said, you know what, I'm going to pretend like I'm your family member, one of your sisters or brothers. I'm sorry. There were two sisters that were there. And it was their mother that was so sick. And so I said, this is the way I would ask questions to the administrator. This is the way I would ask questions to the physician. And it sort of helped the process. So I guess what I'm saying is what I try to do is make things more clear, make things more direct, try to find common strands in what's going on with patients' stories and their loved one's story of that patient. And a lot of times it helps. And I think people hear that there's a way that you can resolve this by collaborating, and it sometimes works in their advantage. Now, there are some people that you'll never please, and yet there'll always be conflict. And, you know, I don't think that we're going to be able to cure families who have great dysfunction. We all have our share of dysfunction in every family, but some dysfunction just will not be cured. And I think we have to be at peace with that, we've tried our best. The American Society of Bioethics and Humanities has been in existence for maybe the last 7 or 8 years, and it drew together different positive factions of bioethics into one huge national organization. And they're trying to come up with ways in which to certify people who do what I do to, not that I'm uncertified, but there would be a way of bringing people into the field so that it would be more available to have these kinds of discussions. But as we are now, it's really new, and I'm kind of at the cutting edge. Not philosophically, we've always had bioethics as a discipline in the academy, but making it more practical, we're just beginning to do this, and we need to do it more. And you're right, we need to talk about the societal ethics involved in resources and what that means. Ask the questions that are important, try to answer them the best we can. But we're just at the beginning stages. But the American Society of Bioethics and Humanities has outreaches, and they have study groups, and they have, you might look them up online. It's a very interesting organization, and it draws international insight as well, but it's an American society, so they have huge symposia, one every year. I think next year it's in Minneapolis, but they move around the country, and it's a place where you can find resources to help do some of the political outreach. And it would be again the first steps, baby steps, because everything is so new. And really, when you think about it, most hospitals don't have people like me, and their ethics committees, you know, function, but they aren't that busy because they're doing other jobs. You know, the ethics committee is something that is not just focused on that. You have, you know, clinicians that have a busy schedule. So to make this long answer, you know, focused, we're moving in that direction, but it's going to take time. Hopefully we get there in time.
Thank you.